than a thwack. As a consequence, the tag didn't unlock properly from the pole tip, and reacting to the prod, the whale raised its fluke to dive, barely missing our boat. I winced as the pole creaked awkwardly, discovering that I had in fact bent it. "That's okay," Jeremy smiled. "I'll bill the Smithsonian," he teased. We watched the whale swim off until the closest one rolled to the surface. "Hey, tag on!" I yelled. I caught a glimpse of the neon housing clinging to the whale's side before it sank back down into darkness. I slumped in the boat, exhausted and happy, as Ari cheered. Jeremy snapped a rapid burst of photos as the humpbacks fluked up and dived deep. Toward the end of the day, we sat atop the bridge of the Northern Song, binoculars and notebooks out. The peak of the herring run in southeast Alaska meant abundant food for predators of all stripes. The Northern Song cruised leisurely into Seymour Canal, a cove off the inner coast of the archipelago. We watched bald eagles by the dozens drop down from spruces to pluck herring thrashing at the surface. They wheeled in a wide spiral, the column giving a clue about what was happening below the water's surface. From the height of the bridge, we watched one, two, and then three humpbacks surge from depth and lunge with mouths agape. It wasn't exactly coordinated bubble netting, more happenstance opportunism. As they closed their mouths, their corrugated throat pouches sagged at the surface until one by one the whales tightened their slack pouches and returned to the deep. Looking around, we realized that we were surrounded by dozens of humpback whales, far into the distance, all gorging on their own balls of herring. It was an astonishing sight, whale snout after whale snout breaking the surface, jaws lagging behind like a scoop, along with trumpeting blows and flashes of scalloped flippers. I couldn't count the number of blows firing around us, all the whales surfacing in the cove. "Pretty amazing," I said aloud, as if I needed to. Everyone else gazed on the scene quietly, some with camera lenses pointed down. The scene felt almost primordial, ripped from a novel about other worlds. But in fact, the factors that let these whales enjoy their herring run feast were all very recent in the timeline of life on our planet. And these factors, which explain why we live in an age of giants, have to do with glacier fields lining mountains far off in the distance. After sorting through all the possibilities, we came to see a clear shift in baleen whales' body size towards gigantism that happened in the last 4.5 million years. Graham Slater conducted different mathematical tests to see whether our data could be explained by any other models of size evolution. An early burst in large size, a bias against preserving large whales, or a simple diffusion of this trait over the course of millions of years, and found that the relatively recent jump toward very large body size in baleen whales was probably real. Put another way, the dramatic increase in whale body size, the thing that makes whales iconic in many ways, happened only in the last few moments of their evolutionary history. This time frame in Earth history is important because it marks the start of profound changes to the oceans during the ice ages about 2.5 million years ago. We still live in this time of alternating glacial and interglacial periods, which seesaw in timing over the course of cycles determined by the periodic wobble of the Earth and variation in its orbit around the Sun. On land, the march and retreat of ice sheets to the latitudes of Seattle, Chicago, and New York has meant seasonal periods of melting and freezing that increase the sediment load for freshwater river systems emptying to the coast. Coupled with stronger wind patterns that have also powered upwelling, these changes to the oceans only a few million years ago set the scene for time-sensitive and dense aggregations of zooplankton to make coastal seas highly productive at certain times of the year. Krill swarms reach their apogee during the summer months, regardless of the hemisphere. In other words, the iconic world of whales we see today off Alaska, Monterey Bay in California, or Stellwagen Bank along coastal Massachusetts happened only with the conditions enabled by recent ice ages. The ice ages made the distribution of ocean-going prey more highly concentrated in local regions over shorter amounts of time. Given all the costs of living life as a rorqual whale, the largest among them, such as blue whales, need to make the greatest return on their feeding investment, which means heading for the highest densities of prey. Once there, the efficiencies of filter feeding with baleen and the anatomical specializations that coordinate lunges become critically important for maximizing the capture of prey that varies in availability. Being a rorqual is just one way to take advantage of this high-density prey availability in the modern world. Large size among other filter-feeding whales, such as right whales and bowheads, confers the same advantages. Being big also means efficiencies in transit to the farthest of these swarms, fending off predators while en route to maximize their yield with massive lunges using increasingly large throat pouches and mouths. The patchy availability of prey enabled by ice age seas provides an ecological explanation for why many different baleen whales all seem to get extremely large within the same time frame of the past 4.5 million years, the last few moments of their over 50 million year history. The worlds that whales lived in made them big, but large body size for land mammals in today's world is correlated with a higher extinction risk. Extreme body size can be an overspecialization itself, requiring vast amounts of resources to sustain. As the largest creatures on the planet, whales live at the knife edge between perfection and perilous adaptation. Their large size can be a liability if the environment changes rapidly, a fact that makes this kind of understanding important, as massive changes to their world are happening quickly, thanks to the behavior of our own species. How successfully whales and humans can share this evolutionary moment in the age of giants is a high-stakes story that's still being written. Part 3, Future. Chapter 13, Arctic Time Machines. In 1846, two tall ships, sails full of cold air, slipped through a passageway choked with black-stained ice floes. The HMS Erebus and HMS Terror were a year into an expedition led by Sir John Franklin in search of the Northwest Passage. Franklin's ships were marvels of the latest technology, armored with iron plating, hulls reinforced with cross planking, and berths warmed by ducts from coal stoves, bearing all the outward confidence of Britain's aim to tame the most remote parts of the globe. What Franklin did not know as his ships snaked through the narrows between Prince of Wales and Somerset Islands was that the caprice of Arctic weather would compound errors of provisioning and set their entire mission on a course for disaster. Ice-locked near King William Island for nearly 2 years, Franklin's crew would bide their time, refusing to adopt indigenous solutions to combat scurvy and eating from tin cans sealed with lead that leached into their food, possibly poisoning them. They perished under harrowing circumstances from starvation and cannibalism, as inferred from Inuit eyewitness accounts and piles of human bones on King William Island bearing the telltale signs of butchery and cooking. The disappearance of the Franklin expedition and the abject failure of over 35 rescue missions meant to find them cast a long shadow that soured the imperial interests of the British in the Arctic. But before all that, in a late summer moment, Franklin most likely would have seen bowhead whales. The species had already been decimated by over 2 centuries of wanton whaling off the coast of Greenland. But they were still present in the far reaches of the Arctic, where whalers would not ply. I imagine Franklin burying his chin in the high collar of his naval gray coat, pausing on the quarterdeck to watch 2 bowhead whales, perhaps a cow and its calf, surfacing out of the aquamarine mirror. The blows of the mother would have towered to the level of the ship's deck, clouds of water droplets hanging momentarily in the cold air. Perhaps Franklin and his officers caught sight of the whale's dull black bodies and ivory chins as mother and calf rolled near the side of the Erebus. After a few moments, the short encounter would be over, and the two pairs, cetaceans and ships of men, would resume their individual fates in different directions. Fast forward to the start of the 21st century, 1,000 miles westward, off the northern coast of Alaska. On an overcast spring day, several dozen native Alaskans, Inupiat women and men, young and old, pull a heavy braided line across a shoreline of landfast ice. The effort requires every able-bodied person in town. The taut end of the rope is wrapped around the tailstock of an immense bowhead whale, a cow harpooned by whaling captains in small boats only hours earlier in the Chukchi Sea. Just like their ancestors, the group succeeds in the unbelievable task of hauling a 55-foot-long mammal carcass out of the water onto solid ice. At the other end, blood drips from the great arched mouth of the whale. The long baleen plates in the mouth are askew, like improperly folded window blinds. After a moment of silence, followed by a few words, one of the whaling captains climbs to the top of the carcass. Without much fanfare, he directs his crew members to begin the careful, arduous process of removing blubber from flanks of the bowhead's body, peeling back foot-thick sections of skin and fat from muscle using large hooks and flensy knives. The blubber, tail fluke, pectoral flippers, and some long back muscles are all set aside in piles designated for whaling crews, families, and everyone in the community. Parts of the carcass will feed an entire household for months. Red-cheeked children running about with unzipped jackets pause in their games to marvel at the whale and press their fingers into the rubbery black skin near the head, leaving temporary, tiny divots. But no one here knows the entire story of this particular whale, which was a calf when it encountered Franklin and his ships. At 200 years old, eras of human history are bookended by her lifetime. She was born before the age of coal, when whaling ships still had sails, and escaped the devastation of Soviet whaling from massive diesel-powered ships with explosive harpoons more than 100 years later. She ingested radionuclides from atomic testing, widespread in marine food webs after World War II, and then she experienced myriad sonic changes to her underwater habitat, from oil exploration, cargo shipping, and military sonar in the past 50 years alone. Over her lifetime, she gave birth to several dozen calves before falling to a 21st century Inupiat harpoon, as many of her relatives did more than a century ago. Lining up the chronologies together, it is possible that the lifetimes of three generations of bowheads, grandmother, mother, and 21st century calves, span more than half a millennium, from Basque whalers sailing galleons west of Greenland in the time of Shakespeare to a 23rd century Arctic Ocean no longer synonymous with ice. Bowhead whales are time machines unlike any other on the planet. Though the scenarios described above are imagined, the basic outlines of this story are fact. Bowhead whales are the only baleen whale species that spends its entire lifetime above the Arctic Circle. Bowheads are known as the one true polar whale for good reason. They alone have the size and strength to deal with the vicissitudes of ice, including the wherewithal to break it up shouldn't suddenly begin to close up around a breathing hole. Many other Arctic species, such as narwhals and belugas, perish under these circumstances. In the summer season, most bowheads migrate from the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas off Alaska east toward the Canadian Arctic, some to the very same embayments where the Erebus and Terror now rest on the ocean floor. By late fall, most then migrate west along the Alaskan shoreline. Some pass through the Bering Strait into the Bering Sea, while others hold position north of the strait until they return east at the turn of the season. This annual cycle forms a figure eight, pinched by the winter pack ice spreading down from the North Pole, forcing large numbers of bowheads to pass relatively close to the northern coastline of Alaska through openings in the ice, called leads. Consequently, sea ice dictates the timing of Inupiat hunts, which have been part of their subsistence culture for thousands of years. In general, whales are like most mammals in that they grow rapidly in the first years after birth until reaching adulthood and then slow down, adding little in the way of length for every added year of growth. With access to abundant carcasses, researchers at whaling stations in the early 20th century counted pregnancy scars on the ovaries of whales and plotted these numbers against total length as a way to gauge the timing of sexual maturity. No similar technique exists for males, which lack ovaries. They found that other large baleen whales, such as blue and fin whales, show remarkable growth profiles, achieving sexual maturity in fewer than 5 years, a rate implying the addition of over 100 pounds of growth per day. By contrast, the first studies looking at similar growth profiles for bowheads showed that they matured more slowly, taking nearly 2 decades on average, until their first pregnancy, not unlike us. Aging a whale is not trivial or straightforward. For toothed whales, a single tooth sectioned lengthwise reveals annual layers, like tree rings. For baleen whales, researchers have to use other so-called accretionary tissues, such as baleen and earplugs, to guess age. Like fingernails or hair, baleen provides only a record of growth tied to the longevity of the tissue, which wears down and is replaced through the course of life. Bowhead baleen records a duration of time on the scale of years to a decade, though certainly not a lifetime. Baleen whale earplugs, accumulations of wax inside the head that don't connect to an external ear opening, show layering that seems to correlate tightly with a whale's length. The only problem for bowheads is that, for an unknown reason, their earplugs do not have layers to be read. In 1992, a 51-foot-long female killed off Barrow, now officially known as Utqiagvik, Alaska, provided much clearer evidence of bowhead's longevity. Having stripped it of its blubber, scientists saw above its shoulder blade what looked like an old injury. We followed the line of scar tissue and sliced into a big, obvious pocket until we heard a crunch. Craig George, resident biologist in Utqiagvik for more than 30 years, told me. They discovered a stone harpoon lodged deep in the bowhead's body. Flint and slate harpoons fell out of favor with native Alaskan whalers by the 1880s, thanks to metal versions introduced by whalers in the 1850s, when Alaska was still Russian territory. Considering that the whale must have been relatively mature at the time to survive such a strike, Craig and his colleagues surmised that the whale, labeled as 92B2, was at a minimum about 130 years old. When they later counted the pregnancy scars on her ovaries, the age that they calculated was completely consistent with a healed wound from the 19th century, 133. Craig and his colleagues more commonly use another technique to age bowheads, capitalizing on fresh tissue from Inupiat hunts, eyeballs. The crystalline lens inside the eyeballs of most every vertebrate animal is composed of proteins that change in chemical structure over an organism's lifetime at a consistent and known rate, keeping time like a clock in a process called racemization. Elsewhere in the body, cells replace these proteins, resetting the clock. But those in the lens have been there since birth, bottled off from the body's circulation. Lenses thus make great biological chronometers, but only if you can find them before decay sets in. When Craig and his colleagues studied a sample of eyeballs collected over several years from recent bowhead hunts, the ages that they calculated confirmed the true longevity of bowheads, with many individuals well over a century in age. The ages that they calculated set records not only for whales, but for any known mammal. In fact, the oldest whale in their data set, a 48-foot-long male, killed in 1995, was an astonishing 211 years old. In other words, it is entirely possible that bowheads born during the time of the Lewis and Clark expedition still swim in the seas off the North Slope. These multiple lines of evidence, from harpoon technology, pregnancy scar counts, and protein racemization, lead tremendous strength to inferences about the longevity of bowheads because these facts, as Craig remarked to me, would have seemed ridiculous if you only otherwise had one clue. When he told his mother, children's book author Jean Craighead George, that bowheads could live more than 200 years, she wrote Ice Whale, about a whale encountering many generations of a single clan of native Alaskans. Bicentenarian whales carry many stories in their bodies, telling us about the past worlds of the Arctic. You just have to know where to look. One great place to look for stories is in a whale's mouth. Baleen is not as perfect a chronometer as eyeball lenses, but it is an accretionary tissue that grows in layers and thus can reveal something about the life of its owner. Baleen plates wear down while in use over a whale's lifetime, but imagine for a moment you could line up plate after plate, decade by decade, over calendar years. With enough baleen plates, you could create a record over centuries. A lot of scientists working on bowheads have had the same thought. They just need enough baleen plates. In the great warehouses of the Smithsonian's off-site collections, baleen plates of bowhead whales are housed in a series of unusually wide metal cabinets, 8 feet long. At their longest, the plates can reach up to 14 feet, though most in the collection are no more than 5 feet long. Baleen becomes frayed with use and entangled with tubules from adjacent plates moving forward and backward on one side of the mouth, like Velcro, to form a dense mat. In life, this tangle forms a sieve on the right and left sides of the mouth to trap incoming prey, a filter for a filter feeder. You can think of baleen as a kind of record-keeping device mounted in a whale's mouth that accumulates a sample of its environment for many years until it wears away. In that way, it is a lot like hair or really long fingernails, keeping a record of an organism's growth for as long as the structure holds together. The longer the baleen plate, the more time recorded from that whale's life. At a molecular level, the composition of baleen acts as a kind of tissue archive, recording subtle differences in the ratio of different weights of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and other atoms consumed by the organism. With each layer of growth, these atoms and the ratios in which they were formed are deposited in baleen, which grows with the seasons. The cyclical bands of growth, like tree rings, show seasonal fluctuations from bountiful times during summer feeding to fasting during migration. Bowheads have absolutely the longest plates of any baleen whale, much longer than those of even blue whales. Lacking any kind of time-stamped recording device for this species, the layers preserved in a baleen plate are the closest we can get to annual snapshots from the past life of an Arctic time machine. Pull out one of the drawers from the baleen cabinets, and this history is literally spelled out on these specimens. In some cases, it's stenciled on the plate in tall, angular print by Yankee whalers, or written on an edge-worn specimen tag. The oldest specimen in the Smithsonian has one such tag, inked in oversized cursive handwriting, stating simply, Arctic Ocean, 1840. Sampling baleen from the early to mid-19th century captures environmental signals from a world before the widespread release of carbon dioxide from industrial fossil fuels into the atmosphere. Since that time, burning fossil fuels has added isotopically lighter carbon into Earth and ocean chemical cycles, adding a distorting layer. Interpreting the signals from a decline in carbon isotope ratios in baleen over the past 170 or so years, is tricky and depends on understanding both climate cycles and food webs. This decline could be the result of longer-term background environmental change, part of episodic cycles driven by dynamics in Earth's orbit, which set oceanic cycles that last centuries or millennia, or it could signal something biological related to the loss of productivity at the base of the food web in the Arctic. Pre-industrial bowhead baleen can give us a glimpse of a deeper view of the oceans before the world changed with the widespread burning of fossil fuels. Bowheads have always had longer life expectancies than we do, but now, within the span of one human lifetime, we are creating changes to the Arctic that mean any bowheads living today do so in a liminal gap between a familiar past and a potentially unrecognizable future. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. The Arctic that existed when I was born was more similar to the one that Franklin saw than it will be to the one my children will know. The most obvious indicator of this change has to do with ice and its different incarnations, from seasonal ice rafting on the sea to older ice formed over several years to near geologic glaciers. Each year, the maximum extent of winter sea ice has steadily dropped, losing more than half its geographic extent and three-quarters of its volume since I was born in 1980. Even older sea ice, which was previously resistant to multiple summer melts, has disappeared. This decline has a distinct downward trend toward a threshold, perhaps as soon as the mid-2030s, below which a summer in the Arctic will be mostly free of sea ice. Then there are the glaciers. The landmass of Greenland holds the greatest amount of glacial ice on the planet after Antarctica, and it's disappearing rapidly. The amount of water locked in these ice sheets is nearly incomprehensible. Adding the volume of water trapped in Greenland's ice to the world's oceans would raise global sea level by more than 20 feet. Other key Arctic components undergoing major changes, such as the warming of the permafrost or tundra soil, independently point to the fundamental unraveling of a unique Earth system in a way that has not happened since the first glaciation of the Arctic more than 3 million years ago, a time before the first bowheads. A bowhead calf born today will live in an Arctic that, by the next century, will be a different world than that experienced by all of its ancestors. A warmer Arctic represents a complex fortune for ice-loving whales. First, an ice-free summer in the Arctic means a less impeded Arctic Ocean, open to increased shipping. Rather than being choked with ice, the Northwest Passage will become an express lane for container ships and oil tankers from Asia to North America and Europe, a faster route than through the Panama Canal. More traffic in the Arctic means the unavoidable realities of oil spills and ships striking whales. If the Exxon Valdez disaster is any guide, an oil spill in remote parts of the Arctic would be a calamity even harder to contain. Ship collisions are a major threat to right whales, the massive, nearest cousins of bowheads, whose numbers never rebounded from whaling in centuries past. There are three species of right whales, and they collectively total only a few thousand individuals across the world's oceans. Their vulnerability is partly due to year-long gestation periods producing a single calf, with about 3 to 4 years between pregnancies. Until 2004, no one had documented a North Pacific right whale calf off Alaska for 100 years, and not for a lack of effort either. Right whales' summertime feeding patterns already take some of them directly into harbors of major cities, such as Boston. Like bowheads, right whales are simply too slow to avoid collisions with incoming ships that can be hundreds of feet long and move 10 times faster than the whales can swim. A warmer Arctic also creates ecological opportunities for invading species. Killer whales, for example, typically avoid the ice-locked waters that bowheads can break up with the high arch of their snout. But a less icy Arctic has made killer whale visits to this part of the globe more frequent and persistent. Rake marks from killer whale bites are not uncommon on bowhead, fins, and flukes. Other Arctic whales, such as narwhals, avoid killer whales as much as possible, though it's unclear whether killer whales kill and eat bowhead calves, as they do with other baleen whales. In evolution, these kinds of sweepstakes events that involve invasions into newly available habitat can have outcomes tilted strongly in favor of one set of species to the detriment of others. For example, when the Panamanian land bridge finally emerged to link the Americas, dogs, cats, bears, and many other placental mammals from the north were much more successful in invading South America than austral animals, such as possums, moving north. The analogous outcome for whales invading cooler latitudes from expanding belts of warm latitudes is very much unclear. Bowheads have the advantage of incumbency, but their home field is changing within the scale of our lifetime, to say nothing of their much longer one. Last, bowheads feed on zooplankton, just 1 to 2 steps away from the base of Arctic food webs. The loss of ice opens entirely new habitats for bowhead prey by giving primary producers, phytoplankton, unobscured by ice, an extended growing season, which in turn increases the abundance of high-calorie krill and slower-moving, lower-quality copepods, both types of crustaceans that are favored by bowheads. Less ice means more mixing of nutrients in the water column, from the surface to the seafloor, which enhances the overall productivity at the base of the food web. The cumulative effect of these physical changes on the biology of the ocean food webs will transform the Arctic Ocean into a pelagic one, an ocean structured more like what we see at temperate latitudes. For the near term, as far as the food factor is concerned at least, bowheads should benefit from a new ocean. But it's not that simple. Rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are driving increases in global temperatures, and the effect of this change will be felt by every organism on Earth, whether in positive or negative ways. The oceans are a dead-end dumping ground for carbon dioxide, which in its dissolved form makes the oceans more acidic. This process has a notable negative effect on any organism that uses calcium carbonate to grow a shell, including krill and zooplankton, that form the primary prey for many species of whales. It may be possible for krill and other shell-forming species to adapt to a newly acidic ocean, but we don't know how fast this kind of evolution might happen, especially relative to the rate of acidification, which may increase in a non-linear way. Often scientists talk about climate change with predictions based on trends that progress in linear ways. The challenge with complex and dynamic systems, those involving cells, organisms, and even whole ocean current systems, is that they can respond in large leaps or shifts from one trend to another, suddenly and with little warning. These tipping points are moments when systems previously buffered against dramatic change finally flip to a different trajectory. Oceans and climate systems have changed abruptly in the geologic past. The question for those living in the Anthropocene is not whether these tipping points exist, but the factors that initiate them and how soon they might happen. Bowheads preceded humans in the Arctic. Skulls and jaws from 10,000-year-old bowheads have been found throughout the islands of the Canadian Arctic archipelago, eclipsing the oldest evidence of indigenous whaling cultures. With weathered, elongate arches and swooping curves, ancient bowhead skulls and jawbones that litter the barren shorelines could be mistaken for shipwrecked timber. As for Franklin's two ships, they now rest on shallow seafloor near King William Island, but his expedition left a scatter of clues, including frozen bones and a single note cached in a stone cairn. These are relics of an era now past, and not just the era of imperialism or exploration. Immense system-wide changes to the ice-bound Arctic are unavoidable, at least through the mid-21st century, barring large-scale geoengineering that could reverse the loss of ice. Whales have interacted with humans for tens of thousands of years, but only in the past few hundred years has such encounters affected their destiny. The first changes of any magnitude happened with the devastation wreaked by industrialized whaling. In the past half century, pollution, both material and acoustic, along with other side effects of industrialized civilization, such as ship strikes or fishing gear entanglement, present clear threats to bowheads and every other whale. There are centenarian bowheads alive today that have witnessed all of these changes. As the Arctic unravels within the scale of our own lifetime, some of these bowheads may still outlive us, reaching a bicentenarian age in an Arctic ocean with far less ice and many more humans. Today, the all-encompassing influence of climate change represents the greatest human impact in magnitude and rate that we have yet had on the lives of whales or any other creature on Earth. Who wins and who loses in this new world of our making remains to be seen. Chapter 14, Shifting Baselines. What an organism eats means everything for its place in the economy of nature. Pull any ecology textbook from before the 21st century off the shelf, and you'll see enshrined the graphic of a trophic pyramid. This pyramid, borrowed from the same visual lexicon that gave American consumers the food pyramid, shows a wide base, followed by smaller, successive steps up the triangle, with a point at the top. These stages are meant to represent the way that energy flows through ecosystems in the natural world, and the corresponding way that biological investment, the collective mass of all the organisms using that energy, winnows at each step. This graphic is a convenient and intuitive way to talk about two important ideas underpinning ecology. First, it shows that energy flows through food webs. Second, it compartmentalizes organisms' roles in a hierarchy, showing the relative number of players at each stage. In a trophic pyramid, the base layer represents the primary energy fixers of the world, including organisms that can harvest sunlight using photosynthesis, such as plants, or more abundant in the oceans, phytoplankton. The next layer, above the primary producers, is composed of primary consumers, such as zooplankton, which feed directly on the sun harvesters, followed by successive stages of consumers, until crowned by the top consumers, mainly big charismatic vertebrates, but also, arguably, humans. We are the biosphere's top consumer. Biomass and marine ecosystem pyramids are actually built differently from those on land. While trophic pyramids on land generally have the step structure of a narrow, stacked pyramid with a very large base, marine pyramids are slightly inverted at the base, with far more biomass and zooplankton than with phytoplankton. This difference is largely about the high rate of turnover in phytoplankton. At any one instant, organisms at this lowest level are not as persistent in the environment, that is, long-lived, as those one level up, and thus don't count much for instantaneous biomass in an ecosystem. As zooplankton, krill sit squarely on the second level of a trophic pyramid, one step above phytoplankton, which converts sunlight into biomass. This ecological organization is the reason that scientists describe baleen whales as feeding merely two steps away from sunlight. As long as they have the means to feed efficiently on this part of the trophic pyramid using baleen, they can capitalize on the greater abundance of prey, by numbers, and minimize energy lost at higher levels. Large baleen whales skip up the pyramid as top predators because there are essentially no creatures that kill them, besides the rare times a pod of killer whales decides to go after an adult. Krill-eating whales thus might not be apex predators in the way that killer whales are, but baleen whales are still fairly characterized as major ocean consumers. For decades, studies pointed to an overwhelming argument that the boom and bust of primary producers in the ocean, phytoplankton, have a direct correspondence to the occurrence of whales in timing and geographic space. In other words, whales follow their food in the ocean. Plankton aren't distributed evenly across the oceans. Instead, their presence is dictated by large-scale oceanographic processes, such as upwelling. Ecologists therefore argued that everything about the ecology of whales was controlled from the bottom up, that lower trophic levels had a deterministic effect on top levels. But there are also top-down trophic interactions that cut against the exclusivity of the bottom-up view. A classic example of top-down trophic mechanisms involves kelp forests off the Pacific coast of the United States. Sea urchins devour kelp fronds, and sea otters are very fond of eating sea urchins. Scientists recognized the impact that sea otters made on the physical structure and expanse of a kelp forest only when sea otters were reintroduced to the Pacific coast after over a century of overhunting, mainly for fur. In places where sea otters were reintroduced, kelp forests rebounded, having been released from the ecological constraint imposed on them by sea urchins. Now add killer whales into the picture. In 1998, the marine ecologist Jim Estes and his colleagues argued that prey switching by killer whales in southeastern Alaska had unforeseen but clear ecological effects on lower trophic consumers and producers such as starfish and kelp. In the field, Jim and his colleagues observed killer whales eating sea otters instead of seals and other marine mammals, leading him to wonder about the implications of a dietary equivalent of making lunch out of popcorn instead of an all-you-can-eat buffet. Their argument was pulled from the same logic as the original study on sea urchins in kelp forests. A dietary switch by an organism at the top of the trophic pyramid had effects that echoed down to the bottom levels. Their proposal led to widespread debate among ecologists about the prevalence of top-down versus bottom-up interactions in food webs. Much of the debate, however, didn't consider recent history. In this case, an outstanding question of what killer whales ate before whaling in Alaska and other parts of the world fundamentally reorganized the number of big consumers in the oceans, including many large whale species that likely served as prey. This question about what happened in marine food webs, what killer whales did before whaling, before the discipline of ecology even existed, underscores perhaps the most important idea in ecology today. We can't assume that the size of animal populations we see today have always been this way. Shifting baselines is an idea to describe our collective cultural amnesia about how the world once was. This kind of amnesia happens when we try to measure a system undergoing massive degradation and in the meantime forget the location of past goalposts, leading to consistently shifting measures of normalcy from generation to generation. Fishery scientists first applied the term of shifting baselines for the real phenomenon of diminished expectations of fish size or yields from overfishing. The result over the years was a dramatic shift in the concept of what would be normal for a fishery, smaller and smaller fish, and fewer of them. The idea has since gained broader traction among conservation biologists because of its utility in describing any ecological system affected by humans. It applies as much to passenger pigeons and bison as it does to whales because no one alive today remembers the full scope of what the baseline abundance of these animal populations was once like. There are ways, however, that we can infer what these very recent whale worlds look like. When there are enough DNA samples available, which is the case for some species of whales, such as humpbacks, scientists can begin to use sophisticated methods to infer what their standing genetic diversity means for the history of their lineage. Humpback whales are among the many baleen whale species where we expect to see signs of genetic bottlenecking because of whaling. At low population sizes, the detrimental effects of insufficient genetic diversity can take hold, inbreeding as one example, and leave a genetic signal that lasts for generations. With some assumptions about mutation rate and knowledge of existing population size, scientists can then estimate population size at different points in the history of a group. One of the startling outcomes of this work in humpbacks was the inference that humpback whales were many times more abundant before whaling than they are today, some 6 times more, according to the results, a figure that conflicts with the only other source of historical data available, whaling logbooks. These latter records provide tabulations of historic kills, but the results from the genetic diversity studies seem to say that logbooks are not telling us the whole story by underestimating pre-whaling populations by several magnitudes. It is hard to discern a likely historical value between these two sources of data. But, if true in any magnitude, the comparison tells us that the depleted world of whales today may be missing much of the ecosystem function and productivity that supported so many more whales only decades or centuries ago. The idea that whale baselines have shifted in the time that we've studied their ecology gives us a new way of looking at what we thought we knew about many species and their lives. Much of the knowledge that we accept as foundational about ecosystem function is born out of fieldwork on a biosphere that has been severely altered by human activity and the resultant removal of huge amounts of biomass. The challenge for any whale ecologist is to understand baselines and even whether such data matter or exist in the first place, relative to the question at hand. For example, did whales strand in different numbers or different ways when there were so many more of them? Or what about those whalefall communities in the deep sea? What were they like before and after whaling removed hundreds of thousands of potential carcasses that would have otherwise rained down to the seafloor? The ecological questions about energy use up and down food webs tend to mostly involve questions about organisms eating one another. But organic waste also factors into the equation. Yes, whale poop matters to the ocean ecosystem on a significant scale. Whale feces aren't particularly solid. They tend to be fleecy and float at the water's surface until they fall apart. As they disaggregate into the water column, they bring nutrients to the surface that were previously sequestered much deeper until a whale ate them at depth and then expelled their remains much farther up in the sunlit zone. Rarely, sperm whales will expel masses of undigested squid beaks that float and hold together like rotten mulch rolled into a ball. These particular feces are called ambergris and were once prized by the perfume industry for the pungent, sweet smell they exude, smoky and almost familiar, like a relative you last saw as a child. In the oceans, zooplankton-like fish keep a cycle of nutrients, mainly compounds with nitrogen, suspended in the photic zone until their remains, fish bones, plankton exoskeletons, shells, rain down on the seafloor in the form of tiny particles of biological debris called marine snow. Eventually, millions of years later, these remains may return to the surface via tectonic uplift. Generally, scientists call the processes that keep nutrients moving through the ocean a biological pump because they move biological productivity across different depths in the water column. But add whales to the picture, especially at the scales of their pre-whaling abundance, and suddenly the role of these large consumers becomes more important for biological pumps in the oceans. Unlike fish and other zooplankton that migrate up and down in a narrow band of the photic zone in step with daylight, whales transport tons of nutrients from much deeper depths all the way to the surface, where they need to breathe and, as it turns out, poop. The act of defecating at the surface, usually after feeding, essentially fertilizes the entire food web, enhancing further productivity and nutrient cycling by other zooplankton. When biologists calculate the amount of biomass that pre-whaling abundances of whales add to the system with their feces, the total amount of nitrogen input into a local food web can exceed the nominal amount brought in by nearby rivers and the atmosphere. whale poop can supercharge a whole ecosystem. Consider, for a moment, what happened to these processes during the course of industrial whaling. The systematic removal of living whales, their flesh for meat and oil, and their bones ground to bone meal or simply dropped overboard, would hinder productivity of these nutrient cycles. We know that we are living in a less abundant world after whaling. Are we somehow living in a world with a depressed ecological function too? That remains an open question. The more we discover about the important roles that whales play in ocean ecosystems, the more it's apparent that the legacy of whaling has far broader consequences than we might have originally imagined. Chapter 15. All the Ways to Go Extinct. I awoke in a strange bed, momentarily disoriented. When I heard howler monkeys calling in the distance and opened my eyes to see netting over my bed, I remembered Panama. We had left Panama City for the Caribbean coast late the previous afternoon. I got up and gathered with my colleagues for a breakfast of eggs, papayas, and coffee set out by our hosts at the small, spare hostel before we set off in pickup trucks. Jorge Velazuarbe and I had come to Panama to collect a fossil whale skull that a local university student had noticed but wisely photographed and left in place. When the student's advisor, a Smithsonian scientist, asked me to come down to Panama to help excavate it, I didn't hesitate. I knew Jorge, then a graduate student and today a museum curator, would also be game. Having grown up in Puerto Rico, he is also an expert in the paleontology of the Caribbean. Based on photos, we could see a fragmented snout bearing heavy, pointed teeth poking out of rock. Surrounding it, an outline of the skull's brain case, which looked to be safely hidden in sediment. From the teeth alone, I hazarded that it might have belonged to a common fossil species found in Europe and North America, although I couldn't be sure. It didn't matter, though. The fossil record of whales from the tropics is meager, and anything as substantive as a skull would be important. The only catch? The tides on this stretch of the Caribbean coast limited access to the ledge where the skull rested to only one day in the calendar year. We would have a matter of mere hours to exhume and safely wrap the fossil. Getting to Panama was relatively easy, at least. The Smithsonian has a deep connection to Panama, braided with the geopolitical history of the country and originating with the canal. The man-made waterway that cuts across 50 miles of land, connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, remains one of the great engineering feats in human history. The United States had negotiated near-sovereign rights to build the canal as a strategic outcome of assisting Panama's separation from Colombia. Soon after construction began on the Panama Canal in 1904, Smithsonian scientists dispatched to control insect-borne diseases in the Panama Canal Zone documented undiscovered flora and fauna of the isthmus. Realizing the scope of biological richness to be studied, the Smithsonian successfully maintained a footprint in the country, which has since expanded to half a dozen field stations today, reaching from ocean coasts to tropical forests and comprising the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. STRI's field stations are more than just shelters for working scientists. They are hubs of scientific inquiry, serving as platforms for the careers of thousands of scientists from all over the world. For scientists interested in deep time, however, Panama is synonymous with its isthmus. The rise of the S-shaped spine that makes up the country is a pivotal moment in recent Earth history. Oceans swept east to west for over 150 million years without any kind of land bridge between North and South America. The narrow bridge of land that makes up Panama today is the result of a set of tectonic collisions generated from a line of volcanic activity and mountain building episodes, which culminated in enough land being pushed upward and eventually out of the water to fully sever any equatorial communication between the Pacific and Atlantic around 3 million years ago. As our truck rambled through a hilly landscape of tangled green forests and farms, road cuts along the way revealed sandy, gray marine rocks I knew to be older than the land bridge, uplifted by the continued tectonic thrusting. Jorge snapped photos and reflected on how the isthmus changed the world, altering both land and sea ecosystems at the same time. Terrestrial species, even lumbering ones like armadillos or giant ground sloths from the south, and bears and camels from the north, were able to wander at will. For marine species, the land bridge meant a complete reorganization of global ocean currents. It severed gene flow and separated evolutionary paths for bryozoans, clams, reef fishes, and probably even whales, although some species of whales would have migrated around Cape Horn or even the Arctic, though only during ice-free interglacial periods. We arrived at the small town of Pinya just after noon and followed GPS waypoints toward the fossil site, ambling down narrow ledges overgrown with vines and brush. Tides easily change the complexion of exposed rock, so it took some time to find the precise location of the skull. Under the high equatorial sun, Jorge and I worked at the wet, sandy rock, nearly nose-to-nose, being careful not to strike the skull, or each other. Usually we would have taken more time, mapped out the bones along a grid, but we were racing against the tides. Years of anatomical training gave me a guide for the location of bones that lay beneath. But you honestly never know until you start digging, carefully, but in this case as quickly as possible. As we dug deeper, we discovered a set of jaws beneath the skull. My hammer stroke had left a clean break in the bone, much to my chagrin. "That's why glue exists," Jorge joked, a common refrain. We applied some acrylic glue mixed in the field and continued our work. Watching the incoming tide, we managed to tunnel under the block of rock containing the skull and jaws, wrapping the coffee table-sized block in spool after spool of plaster bandages. We hauled the block and our equipment higher up on the shore and took a few moments to rest, the first pause after 4 hours of furious work. The plaster had barely cured by the time the excavation pit was underwater. Tomorrow's tide, like every other one for the rest of the year, would be at the wrong time or height to permit a return. Exhausted and sweaty, we held up chalky hands to each other as we smiled and labeled the plaster block with all the appropriate landmarks to orient it back in the lab. This side up, a tracing of the outline of the skull and jaws position, and a note of where to open the plaster cocoon, cut here. We wouldn't know until months later, but we were wrapping up a species new to science, which ended up telling us as much about extinction and river invasions and cetaceans as it did about the Isthmus of Panama. Many species of whales, even large baleen ones, occasionally migrate up freshwater rivers, but the vast majority of them are temporary visitors, inquisitive, or just plain lost. Only a few lineages of true river dolphins exist, with the required specializations needed to live in freshwater rivers that run hundreds and even thousands of miles away from the ocean. Getting to their habitats requires muddy boots science, forays inland through forests, streams, and countrysides. Their obscurity and the increasing rarity of these lineages means that few people actually get an opportunity to see wild, living river dolphins in the Ganges or Amazon, some of the last places where they still survive. We have a good sense of the range of adaptations that whales need for freshwater life, because the transition from seagoing to riverine habitats has happened several times across several different continents. Each lineage could be thought of as an evolutionary experiment. The traits they share tell us about the broader evolutionary solutions required for whales to adapt to freshwater habitats. For example, unlike almost every oceanic whale, river dolphins have low dorsal fins and highly flexible necks. They have broad, fan-like flippers instead of scythe-shaped ones. They also have strikingly small eyes. One species, the South Asian river dolphin, has hardly any eyes at all. Scientists suspect this latter trait has to do with the murkiness or high turbidity of rivers with suspended sediment. It means less of an emphasis on vision, which is fine for an echolocating mammal. Echolocation is akin to seeing with sound. Imagine toothed whales possessing acoustic flashlights whose beams get focused with a turn of the housing. All of those beams scan the external environment, returning echoes of whatever is out there, whether inanimate, desirable, like prey, or to be avoided, like predators. What is perhaps surprising is the solutions for living in freshwater don't seem to require drastic changes.